This is A-State Connections on KASU. I'm Jonathan Reeves. This is the weekly segment called A-State Connections and Created State, Making Connections That Count. In this segment, you'll hear a couple of presentations from the Created State Virtual Symposium that took place in April. These presentations are from the College of Nursing and Health Professions at Arkansas State University. First is Nick Haywood with his presentation, Dual Task Screening for Identification of Persistent Concussion Effects in Intercollegiate Football Players.
The purpose of this study was to determine if reaction time in both visuomotor and whole body reaction agility were predictors in sustaining lower extremity injuries in players of a Division I Football Bowl Series, or FBS for short. There are approximately 36 injuries that occur for every 1,000 athletic exposures, and a leading cause for this is from poor body mechanics and control. There are prediction models that have examined the role of core muscular endurance and fatigue on musculoskeletal injuries to support this. However, there has been no injury prediction model to date that have looked at a Division I FBS football team. Visuomotor reaction time involves the central and peripheral vision and is the time it takes for a person to visually see a stimulus and the person to react to that stimulus. Whole body reaction agility is essentially the same thing, except the entire body is needed to react and move. In our study, there was a total of 102 Division I players baseline tested during the preseason. In total, there were 7 tests, 3 tests used on a light board known as the reflection edge, and 4 tests done on a separate device known as the tracer. The reflection edge captured the athlete's visuomotor reaction time on an LED touchscreen light board, and the tracer tested their whole body reaction agility with a monitor and a video camera. The 3 tests used for the reflection edge were Big G, Go No Go, and Right and Left Execution, or RAIL for short. Big G tested true reaction time and accuracy. In Go No Go, the athlete placed their fingers on a home base and were told only to touch their green boxes and not the red boxes. The last test, RAIL, would ask the athlete to touch purple boxes with their right hand and touch yellow boxes with their left hand in order to test right and left hand reaction time. The 4 tracer tests were lateral agility, lateral flanker, diagonal agility, and diagonal flanker. On the monitor, the athlete sees an avatar of themselves and where virtual bumpers appear on the screen and then have to move to the bumper to make them disappear. The lateral agility test is where the athlete would move to their left or right depending on where the bumper was and return to the starting point. The diagonal agility is the same except they move backwards, right or left diagonally. Both of the flanker tests would have 5 arrows on the top of the screen and the athlete would move the direction the center arrow was pointing. Sometimes the arrow would be pointing with the other 4 and the other times the arrow would be pointing the opposite way. The athlete would need to see the middle arrow and determine the direction it was pointing before they would disappear on the screen. The flanker tests are similar to the agility tests except a bumper appears on both sides of the athlete. All of the baseline data from these test batteries were gathered and used to create a prediction model for who is at high risk for musculoskeletal injuries. During the preseason and 12-game regular season, lower extremity musculoskeletal injuries were counted for the model after the season had ended. Linear and logistic regressions reduced the original 102 variables to the final 3-factor prediction model. The multivariable prediction model was derived from a series of analyses for determining relative predictive power of the variables. The interaction effects of the predictors were assessed in 3 ways. The first was graphic representation of the interaction between 2 predictors. The second was combining predictors and examining through a 2x2 cross-tabulation table. And the third was calculating the Mantle-Hansel common odds ratio. Our final 3 factors were Big G average reaction time, lateral agility maximum acceleration, and diagonal flanker speed asymmetry. Asymmetry is the difference between the speed going to the right versus going to the left. The optimal cut point via ROC analysis found greater than or equal to 2 predictors, meaning the odds ratio for a player with any combination of the 2 or more predictors had 14 times greater odds of suffering a musculoskeletal injury compared to someone with less than 2 predictors. The clinical relevance of our results demonstrated both whole body reactive agility and visuomotor reaction time are predictors for musculoskeletal injury for Division I football players. We acknowledge the specific factors and their cut points may differ from team to team. This method of data analysis identifies those who are at high risk for injury and allow athletic trainers to implement a remedial program to prevent future injuries.
And that was Nick Haywood. Next is Allison Hitt with her presentation, an examination of referral rates for diabetic self-management education.
When looking at diabetes, it's one of the most prevalent chronic diseases in the United States. Each year, 1.5 million people are diagnosed with diabetes. The prevalence rate for diabetes in 2015 was estimated at 30 million Americans. That's 9.4% of the U.S. population. When you look at Arkansas, the rates are even higher at an estimated 12.1%. Diabetes self-management is so important for people with type 2 diabetes. There has been an associated increased use of primary care and preventive services and less frequent use of acute care and inpatient hospital services when patients have diabetes self-management education. Patients who participate in diabetes self-management education are also more likely to follow best practice treatment recommendations, and they have a lowered Medicare claims cost. The purpose of this study is to examine the rates of referrals to diabetes self-management education for male and female patients ages 40 to 65 in a local primary care clinic in Paragould, Arkansas, comparative to the national rate of 5 to 7%. In 2015, the American Diabetes Association, American Association of Diabetes Educators, and Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics issued a joint position statement on the importance of diabetes self-management education in type 2 patients. The position statement included an evidence-based diabetes education algorithm that visually depicts when to refer people with type 2 diabetes to education services. They identified four critical times: upon diagnosis, during annual assessment, when a person with diabetes has new complicating factors, and then lastly, upon transitions in care. The findings from our research project. The results of this quality improvement project revealed that in this current clinic setting, 52% of patients with diabetes had a referral in place for education. This equated to 26 out of the 50 charts that were reviewed had a documentation of the referral in place. For the 26, 12 are male patients, 14 were female patients, and the average age of the patients was 60. So when you look at these numbers for this particular clinic, they are much higher than the national average, which is only 5 to 7%. So this clinic did exceptionally well. We would like for them to continue that, and we want to share with other providers some action plans on ways to increase the referral rates. And that's just providing education to the providers as well, letting them know the importance of diabetes self-management for their patients with type 2 diabetes. A marketing plan that focuses on the benefit would also be beneficial. And then if there were more diabetes self-management programs in place. And then lastly, if we were able to use telehealth and more mobile services, this might increase a provider's willingness to make the referral also, and also makes it easier for the patients. Just a few limitations for this study, just that basically it's a very small study. Only 50 patient charts were reviewed. It is at a small clinic in rural Arkansas with only three providers in the clinic.
That was Allison Hitt. The next presentation is from Lauren Huff with her presentation, A Local Clinic's Compliance Rate of Screening for Type 2 Diabetes.
The leading cause of death globally is cardiovascular disease. Associated risk factors with cardiovascular disease include obesity, smoking, hypertension, diabetes, and hyperlipidemia. These risk factors are modifiable. Diabetes affects approximately 30 million people, or 9.4% of the United States population. Of these 30 million individuals that are affected, an estimated 7.2 million have not been diagnosed. Obesity affects 1 in 3 adults, and as we mentioned earlier, is a modifiable risk factor associated with cardiovascular disease, along with diabetes. It is currently recommended that patients that are obese are being screened for type 2 diabetes by their primary care provider with a hemoglobin A1C, a glucose tolerance test, or a fasting blood glucose level. Screening for the population is recommended by the United States Preventative Task Force for patients that are between the ages of 45 to 70 years of age and that are also obese. The purpose of this study was to determine the compliance rate of screening for type 2 diabetes according to the U.S. Preventative Task Force recommendation in a rural primary clinic located in Forest City, Arkansas. The primary objective of this study, once again, is to determine the compliance rate of completing a screening for type 2 diabetes via an A1C reading in a rural primary clinic. Analyzing the clinician's screening compliance rate will allow for practice changes by the clinician to improve screening rates if needed. As these screening rates are improved, the overall health outcomes of the patient population will benefit. In completing this analysis, an IRB was obtained through Arkansas State University. The study was conducted using a retrospective chart audit. And this chart audit included 50 charts that were reviewed through an EMR in the primary clinic. The total population seen between September 1st and November 1st of 2019 was analyzed. The data collected included age, sex, race, current BMI, and if the screening had been completed. Sample population information. The inclusion criteria for this analysis included male and female patients that were between the ages of 45 to 70 years of age, that also had a diagnosis of obesity and had a procedure code for an A1C screening completion. Exclusion criteria for the sample population were those patients that were less than 45 years of age or older than 70 years of age. If the patient already had a diagnosis of diabetes, they were not included in the analysis. And patients that did not have a diagnosis of obesity listed were not included in the data analysis. In completing the data analysis of the 50 charts reviewed, 38% of this patient population had an A1C screening completed. This rate of screening is lower than the rate that was analyzed by the United States Preventative Task Force. That rate was at 50%. The findings of this analysis show that there is room for improvement in the screening rate at this local rural clinic. As clinicians increase the screening rate, early diagnosis can be made. An earlier diagnosis leads to earlier education, improved health outcomes for the patient, and a decrease in the overall cost of health care. An interesting fact that I was able to note in reviewing the data analysis was as these screenings were completed in the 50 charts I reviewed, those that had an A1C completed were able to have a new diagnosis noted in 4 patients. Once again, as an earlier diagnosis is completed, the patient is able to have earlier referrals for a diabetic educator, podiatry if needed, and endocrinologist to assist and collaborate with the primary healthcare provider in managing these patients with a type 2 diabetes diagnosis.
And that was Lauren Huff. Final presentation is from Tabitha Johnson, as she gives her presentation titled, Depression Screenings in a Rural Primary Care Clinic Compared to the National Average.
Introduction and purpose. Depression is a significant healthcare issue. Major depressive disorder or clinical depression are other terms commonly used for depression. Depression is characterized by sadness, loss of energy, loss of interest in activities, difficulty sleeping, appetite changes, difficulty thinking, or even thoughts of taking one's own life. Undiagnosed or untreated depression can lead to severe problems and adverse outcomes such as alcohol or drug addiction, quitting work or getting fired, physical health complications, or even harm to oneself or suicide. It is essential to diagnose and treat depression to reduce these problems and establish positive outcomes. Depression can affect anyone, but it is more common in women than men. Depression is the most treatable mental illness. Most people affected by depression can gain improvement and overcome symptoms with the correct diagnosis and appropriate treatment. Genetics, personality, biochemistry, and environmental factors all play a role in the chances of depression. Serious medical illness, trauma, or drugs or alcohol abuse can also increase the incidence of depression. Depression is treated with medications or psychotherapy, also known as talk therapy, or a combination of both. Objectives. The purpose of this study is to determine the number of patients over 21 years old in which a depression screening tool is being effectively used to evaluate the need for treatment yearly in a family practice clinic. By determining the amount of depression screenings conducted in this clinic, it will bring awareness to the providers and help monitor the need for improvement or how well they are doing compared to the national average. The study is beneficial in identifying the need for depression screenings and improving patient outcomes. Methods. IRB was obtained through Arkansas State University. A retrospective chart review was conducted using 50 random charts from January 2018 through January 2019. Mathematical equations were used to determine the percentage of patients in which a depression screening was conducted during this time. The percentage determined was compared to the national average of 4.2%. Population. This retrospective chart review included age, gender, and race. Charts reviewed included patients 21 years of age or older. No exclusions to race were identified. Male and female patients were both reviewed. Exclusions to the study were charts with the ICD-10 code of F79, intellectual disabilities, and F33, depressive disorder. No charts reviewed were under the age of 21. Data analysis of the 50 charts reviewed revealed a percentage of 16% of patients were screened for depression in this rural clinic in Arkansas. Even though this percentage is low, it is significantly higher than the national average of 4.2%. The average age of the patients in this study were 46 years old. Of the patients screened in this review, only 6 were males and all were Caucasian. Discussion and plan. In 2016, the U.S. Preventative Task Force established recommendations stating the general adult population should be screened for depression to accurately establish diagnosis, treatment, and follow-up. Despite these recommendations, screenings are low and a need for improvement is indicated. Bringing awareness to the need for depression screenings will greatly improve utilization of screenings and overall patient outcomes with depression. Increasing awareness is the first step.
And that was Lauren Huff. Final presentation is from Tabitha Johnson, as she gives her presentation titled, Depression Screenings in a Rural Primary Care Clinic Compared to the National Average.